This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net and also by Violet Microphones at violetusa.com.
And now, our feature presentation,
Twirt.
On Twirt number 8, it's a Thanksgiving smorgasbord. We'll take you from the microphone all the way to the transmitter.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And this week, it's Chris Tarr from Milwaukee, Chris Tobin from New York City, and Colleen Kelly joins us from the Twit Network.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, welcome in to This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and along with me, joining me, are a couple of our infamous co-hosts. First of all, we have from New York City, Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Good evening, Kirk. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Well, I'm doing well. The pictures in the post office are down, so the infamous part of my reputation is somewhat waning, but I'm okay.
How's the city that never sleeps?
Oh, it's very busy right now. The holidays begin actually about 3 hours ago.
Oh, you guys have a parade on Thursday, Thanksgiving, don't you?
Yes, the Macy's Day Parade. I believe it's the 83rd or 84th parade.
Yeah.
This year it's taking a different route. So there's a slight change in the direction it takes, so it's got everybody up in arms.
You know, actually, Chris, I was... about a week ago, I was actually trying to plan some kind of a last-minute outing for me and my family to New York City, because I do have a business reason to go there, but we just couldn't work it out, and my wife has to work, so it wasn't going to work out. But we looked at going to the Thanksgiving Day Parade and noticed that they were talking about this year there are some intricate turns for the balloons to make.
That's correct. Normally, the parade route comes down Central Park West, crosses over to Broadway at 59th Street, comes down Broadway and continues to Herald Square at the home of Macy's, the world's largest store. However, due to some changes in the way the city has decided to allow foot traffic on Broadway, they've closed off part of Broadway in the Times Square section of the city.
Yeah.
So the only good thing is that 7th Avenue and Broadway cross each other at Times Square. So you'll come down Broadway, come across 7th Avenue, still coming through Times Square. Then you're making a left turn going east on 42nd Street.
Oh,
one block.
Oh.
That's right. One block to 6th Avenue. And then you make a right turn going south onto 6th Avenue and take your way down to Herald Square.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
It's going to be exciting. Have they practiced those balloon turns yet?
They say they've been practicing out in New Jersey where the balloons are tested, inflated, and whatnot. So it's going to be interesting.
I don't know. You sure can't simulate that New York area in New Jersey, can you?
Not really, no. No. The buildings create the canyon, you know, the canyon effect, the winds, the vortexes, as somebody told me once. So it'll be interesting. I think they'll do fine.
I can't wait to watch. I'm going to see if I can watch it in high def tomorrow morning. Chris Tobin, you are with CBS Radio, right?
Yes. Yes.
So... all of your opinions are your own, I'm sure.
Oh, they are indeed. They do not represent anything from the organization or my employer. Not at all.
Also joining us from Milwaukee is Chris Tarr. Hello, Chris.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm terrific. How are you?
I'm getting ready for the big tryptophan overload tomorrow.
What's fan overload?
Tryptophan overload.
Oh,
from turkeys.
Sorry. I parsed the word wrong. I'm going to a trip to fan overload.
There you go. Now I'm also going to be watching the big McGuanago, the small burb that I live in, the McGuanago Thanksgiving Parade.
Mm.
Starts on the north side of Main Street. It's going to go down two blocks and then be finished. So we're all excited about that. It is a little change from last year where we went 3.5 blocks.
Wow.
But I think we can handle it. Okay. So we're excited.
Can I watch it in HD?
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely.
It's just got to show up, right?
We had some public access channel somewhere. Sure.
Chris, you work with the folks at Intercom there in Milwaukee, yeah?
That is correct. I'm the director of engineering for Intercom's Milwaukee stations and also their Madison stations.
Seems like you have a website, too, you'd like to promote now and then.
You know, I do. Actually, I have two. There's of course, geekjedi.com, which is my main address. But I also have an online forum for engineering called The Virtual Engineer. And that's at broadcastengineering.info. And it's a great message board. A lot of engineers there discussing war stories and things like that as well.
Cool. Hey, Chris, I may have gotten your links wrong. So sometime during the show, why don't you email me or text me on Skype those links, and I'll make sure I get them right in the show notes.
Absolutely.
Hey, welcome in to all the listeners. We're glad you're here. I'm Kirk Harnack, the host of the show, and I work for the folks at Telos, Omnia, and Axia. That's my day job. And by night, I do occasionally play engineer. I've got four radio stations that I'm part owner of in Mississippi and American Samoa. So I do try to keep my hands in it from time to time. And so there you go. That's our backgrounds. And today we've got what we're calling a Thanksgiving buffet show. That means it's a smorgasbord. It's a potpourri. And I think we're going to tackle one of the questions that we've gotten from our website. That's really a very big question. Short question, big answer. And the question basically is, what's involved in hooking up a radio station from microphone to transmitter, or maybe it's an internet station, from microphone to server? What's involved? And so we're going to answer that question. The three of us, me, Chris, and Chris, are going to, on this show in the next 55 minutes, we're going to try to answer that question from a simplistic point of view. Yes, this hooks to this, and you know the foot bone connects to the ankle bone and so forth. But we're also going to examine some of our choices as broadcast engineers in terms of some of the most common equipment that we pick out to use for broadcasting, like microphones, like headphones, like an audio console or an audio processor, and where do we put that processor, or CD players, maybe some automation or computers. Just how do we get these things hooked up? What sort of engineering, what sort of connections are acceptable maybe for a home studio, and what would be acceptable in a professional environment like CBS Radio in New York or Entercom in Milwaukee? And I could tell you what's acceptable in American Samoa. So that's the subject matter. The question is, what do you have to do to hook up a radio station? What hooks to what? So I think probably a good place to start, gentlemen, would be you know, some of the things we talk about are going to depend on what you're using the station for. And I guess it might be a good idea to at least chat about that for a few minutes, talk about what goes in a typical studio. Like this studio that I'm talking to you from right now at my palatial office of important business here in Nashville, Tennessee. Obviously, there's a microphone, and there is a bit of mic processing involved, and there's something to mix the voices together from Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin, and there's something to record those things on. Then there actually is some post-production. Since this is not a live show, we do a little post-production to try to make the voices sound better. We cut out a few of the mistakes that people make from time to time, and put some music at the beginning, music at the end, and publish the show. So if you're going to do a show like that, it can be pretty simple. If you're going to do a live show, you might need a few more gadgets in the studio to produce various sources, from music to talk to commercials, whatever you may have. So that's my perspective. Tell you what, let me take a quick lead. Yeah, I'll keep talking for a minute and tell you what we have at a typical studio. Let's say in our radio station in Mississippi, Cleveland, Mississippi. We've got a little radio station there called WKXY, and it's about as simple as you can possibly get a radio station to be. It's a small town, about 15,000 people. It's a country music format. We do a lively morning show with some live guests, plenty of guests by telephone. And in that studio, we have some furniture that's big enough to work with, a big U-shaped piece of furniture. This particular piece of furniture came from Arrakis Furniture, which is now Graham Studios. So we have a nice big U-shaped furniture. It was a knockdown, build-together, on-site piece of furniture. I think it was, we probably bought that piece of furniture 10 years ago, and it was about $2,500 at the time. In that studio, we also have three microphones. These mics are, for the life of me, I can't remember what they are. I'm going to have to go look at a picture of the studio. I want to say they might be RE20s from ElectroVoice. I'll correct that if it's wrong. These mics feed into in our studio, we happen to have an Axia audio system. I work for the company, so I got a good deal on the equipment. We go into a microphone node that has mic preamps built into it. And then the audio console runs on a network, so there's a little network switch there. It's a little Cisco 2960 switch, and the Axia audio console and the Axia DSP mixer. Also sources to that equipment, well, we have a couple of computers. One of them is an automation computer, and it happens to be called a Stork. Stork is the name of the automation. They also do a service where they do just-in-time delivered voiceovers. So they do voice tracking during the good part of our day, our broadcast day, when we're not live on the air. But they're just in time. They're recorded a few minutes before they actually air and delivered by files over satellite. We also have just a standard Windows XP computer that is there to play back production that we've done, or work parts, sound effects, some jingles when we're on live. It's used for that kind of thing. We have a telephone hybrid. We can bring in different phone calls. We use a combination of our business phone system with the telephone hybrid. So from the business phone system, we can select a line that we want to put on the air. That line is directed to a telephone hybrid, and that the audio in and out from that hybrid feeds into the Axia audio system, so we can put the caller on the air. And whatever we say on the console goes back to the caller through a system called Mix Minus. We'll get into that a little bit later on. Also in the studio, we have, of course, there's a monitor amplifier that feeds a couple of speakers that are hung up on the wall. They're, I think, JBL Control 5 speakers. We have an on-air light that's run by a relay that goes on every time you turn the mic on. And there's a big screen TV in the studio, so you know we can all be well informed as to what's going on from the Weather Channel or Fox or CNN or MSNBC. In another room, we feed the audio that's output from the console. We feed that to another room where we have an audio processor. There's an Omnia 1 FM audio processor there. The output of it, now here's where it's going to vary for different people. The output of that audio processor feeds, in our case, into a studio transmitter link. It operates at about 950 megahertz, and it carries what we call a composite signal. So what comes out of the Omnia 1 is what we call an FM composite, or an FM baseband, or an FM multiplex signal. And it contains the FM signal formatted to go right into the transmitter. So it has the left plus right, the left minus right, and the stereo pilot. So that's what leaves our building, and then it goes to the transmitter site, where it's put onto, in our case, 92.1 megahertz, and then covers a part of the Mississippi Delta area. So from mic to transmitter, there you have a very typical, very small radio station. Let's run to Chris Tarr here. Chris, maybe you could describe a bit about how are some of your studios different, more complicated, or as simple as what I just described.
Well, you know, when a mom studio and a dad studio fall in love and they get to get no. It's actually about pretty much what you're talking about. We have analog consoles, so that's where we've kind of vary. Instead of having all the networking gear and things like that, we use an Audio Arts analog console, which mixes the audio. Instead of being in the digital realm using DSP, using varying voltages on slide pots and things like that. But we also have an automation system. We use Maestro. We also have something called Vox Pro, which is how we edit phone calls. For example, you know, our top 40 station, a lot of people call in for requests and stuff that they put on the air. So they call in, and through the Telos phone hybrid, we can talk to the caller in the studio without having to pick up the phone. They just talk in the microphone. They can hear the caller and the speakers, and it's all recorded in this Vox Pro system, which is basically a digital audio editor. So they'll have their conversation, and the announcer, when the phone call is over, can go back and edit it and tighten it up and make it sound real good, and then play it back on the air. So we have that system. Plus, we have the mic processing, you know, take the audio for the microphones. We use RE20s, and they go through Symmetrix 528E microphone processors, and those get fed to the consoles as well. From there, from that nerve center, before I get that far, I should also add, we also have a routing system where we can take, you know, our remote equipment, our remote pickup units for live remotes, the phone systems for live broadcasts and things, and bring those all up in the studios as well. So we take all that in that nerve center, which is the broadcast console, and we feed that out. It goes through an EAS box, emergency alert system, that has to, you know, be able to block whatever's going out on the air to provide alerts. Goes through a delay system, which is basically your profanity delay. So if somebody says something bad on the air, you can dump it out, cut it out. And then from there, it goes to processor. In my case, we use TransLangTech Ariane AGCs ahead of everything. So it goes to there, and then it gets split off to feed our audio stream and monitor systems and things like that. Then it goes through what we use for a studio to transmitter link. Instead of using the 950 megahertz system, we do have that as a backup. Our primary link is through a T1 circuit, through a data circuit. We discussed this two or three shows ago. The Interplex T1 system, which takes that audio, divides it up into specific time slots and data, Twitter site where it's assembled and put back on the air. So it's, you know, similar to what you're doing, just a little bit, you know, different things here and there. But it does have all the same basic building blocks.
Okay. Chris Tobin, you've got a number of different complicated situations there. And Chris Tarr just described a typical one of his. Chris, when you and I met, you were primarily taking care of WINS, W-I-N-S, which seems to me to be a really complicated setup because you've got give us 20 minutes, we'll give you the world kind of news.
Yes, it's an old news. What's that, Kirk?
You want to talk about that one or one of your other stations there in New York?
Well, I probably should explain to the audience that my responsibility in CBS Radio New York City, we have five radio stations in one building. So our studio design is based on the ability to route audio from any one of the five studios, I should say more than five production studios involved. So I think it's something like 15 studios altogether. So our approach is a little different than what, say, Chris Tarr has or even you, Kirk, for your single station or a smaller footprint that doesn't require massive routing, just to clear the water. But, yes, Kirk, when you and I talked and you came to New York, WINS, 1010 WINS Radio is an all-new station, and that station alone has three air studios that go on the air every 20 minutes. So if you can envision the top of the hour, 00, 20 past, 40, we jump through each studio reporting news, New York City, national, international. Along with that, we take in live reports, the reports being weather, traffic, business, and sports. The weather and traffic take place 144 times a day on the ones.
Oh, my goodness.
They're live elements, so the anchor, you know, plays the sounder, and then the traffic and the weather people listening to their mix minus and know their cue. It goes live. It's not taped. It's literally live to air. And there have been times when the reporter, the weather or traffic person is a little late, and you hear the sounder playing, and it's nobody talking.
Yeah.
But it's very busy. So it's three studios rotating three times an hour, along with reporters doing live to air reports from news events, along with the sports, weather, traffic, and news elements.
What are some of the different equipments or technologies that bring those live reports in to, to a console?
Right. Well, that's where we come into the console system we're using is the Harris product called Vistamax. It allows us to route audio throughout the plant where necessary. In the studio itself, starting at the microphone where the anchor or the presenter sits, it's an SM7 microphone. Just so you know, we were using RE20s at one time. We did a test with the SM7. The anchors, programming folks, thought the SM7 had a smoother sound, less of that mid-range. So we start at the SM7. From there, it goes into a mic processor, the Symmetrix 528E, pretty standard for everybody to use, just to level the audio a bit because everything else that you hear is processed to some degree. And from there, into the console. The other technologies we use with the console, incoming traffic reports come to us on a dedicated radio line from the local phone company, Verizon in this case, and has an ISDN backup. Our weather service comes in on a dedicated 56K digital circuit with MusicCam ISDN codecs on either end, dedicated always-on circuit, so the weather folks can come to the newsroom at any time we need them. If there's a change in the weather, it impacts the city folks, we can quickly call them and go for it and be up and running, no dialing up and worrying about stuff. So that's just three. And then we have also our business reporter from the New York Stock Exchange. He comes into us on a radio line as well with an ISDN backup. And sports is the same way, radio line with ISDN backup. So those are the technologies that bring it in to the console.
Where did
from
your,
there...
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was wondering, from what source does your sports come in? From some other CBS property?
No. That comes in from a sports service. Along with, I think it's part of the Shadow Traffic Service, Shadow Metro Network Service.
Ah, okay.
Morning sports, I will say Morning Drive, is from our sister station, WFAN, the all-sports station. So Morning Drive, we have our sports reports coming from our sister station. Middays, evenings, weekends, it's from the sports service, traffic and sports service, Metro Shadow Traffic. So from there, and this is taking place in three studios every 20 minutes. So we switch studios, keep going around the clock. From there, the output of that summing system, the audio travels to an Ariane transatlantic processor, which then is fed to a passive distribution system, which basically takes the output of that processor, feeds it to 950 STL, which is our primary, and then two T1s using Intraplex frames to get audio out to the transmitter side, along with other ancillary needs. And then we have a fourth backup, which is an IP codec on a DSL line, that actually has a DS, an ISDN backup to that. So basically, I have two radio links, one 950, one T1, one terrestrial T1, and then ISDN and DSL for paths out to our transmitter facility. So the idea is that we're always on. And it makes it out to the transmitter, and from there it's processed using a combination of Orbband and Omnia for HD and for the analog in the transmitter, and off it goes, 50,000 watts, covers New York City, Connecticut, New Jersey, and parts beyond. At night, the SkyWave is really nice, and at this time of year, we get a lot of QSLs from folks in Europe.
Gentlemen, I have good news. I've been able to locate and bring in a really wonderful lady, and that is Colleen Kelly from the Twit Network. Hi, Colleen.
Hey, how you doing?
We're great. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Just kind of finishing up here at Twit before Thanksgiving.
Say hi, if you would, to Chris Tarr and Chris Tobin.
Hello, Chris and Chris. How are the Chrises this lovely evening?
I'm doing very well, Colleen. Thank you.
I thought I'd bring Colleen. I noticed she was online because Colleen is the engineer for the Twit Network. And Colleen, you mostly do IT work, but you also have just really gotten your feet wet with both video and audio work at the Twit Network.
Yeah, the funny thing about pretty much all technologies I've noticed now is that everything is done with computers and networking. Everything. I mean, if you sell Axia products and work for Axia, and Axia is a gigantic computer that uses TCP/IP networking to send all the packets around. So in the end, you know, I do an audio and video production engineering job, but it's all IT. And I come from a complete IT background, not audio and video. It's just a different type of data to put in and get out of your computers.
Indeed. You and I got to meet a few months ago, and we were looking at the way that Leo Laporte used to do his shows and podcasts. And it was a very simplistic setup, like, frankly, a lot of our listeners either have or are setting up for home studios or small radio stations. Did Leo just have a small Mackie board or something to get started with?
Yeah, well, when I first got here about a year and a half ago, he was just doing audio podcasts, and he was not doing any sort of video content, and he was producing it all himself. He had a Mackie 1620 16-channel audio mixer analog, and he was using a hodgepodge of some XLR cables, some phono cables, some balanced, some not balanced, a couple of mini cables going to RCA, and all sorts of random stuff. And he was doing everything digitally. I mean, he was using Skype for his guests, and he was an XLR, dynamic microphone user, all going into this. All sources were either analog or converted to it into the mixer, where it ended up becoming digital again in the FireWire card going back out. So it was going through all these silly conversions and all sorts of stuff. So, it worked. And a lot of times analog is easier because it's kind of relatable. You know, you plug in a cable on one end and on the other end and it kind of works. But it was funny because we'd always be chasing around all of these really silly noises and never have the right cable. And is it male? Is it female? And, where's that hum coming from? So
it is a bit different when you do it digitally with networking. And we're not here on the show. We're not trying to push one tech over another. We're just trying to explain to people what a lot of the basic parts are and how they fit together.
And that's not really, my point. My point is more that we do everything here from an IT perspective. We have Skype, we have video cameras, we do live streaming. Everything ends up being digital. And we were trying to use traditional analog concepts of audio mixers and an audio mixing board with our computers. So we'd put these expensive USB sound cards to feed XLR analog audio into an analog mixer, which would then have an internal board feeding out via FireWire back into another computer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So our lives started getting much easier when we kind of started thinking to ourselves, oh, well, we're really computer people and working for computer people, so let's just do computer stuff.
Well, you do have really a pretty complicated setup there. I mean, it started out as a typical podcast-type facility when Leo started alone on the second floor of that building, but now you might do four Skypes at the same time, each one needing its own mix-minus.
Well, that's four Skype videos at the same time, but then you can also add on the additional Skype audio that's in front of him, which may be video soon enough, and all of the different people in studio, and it gets rather complicated very quickly.
Yeah, you got four mics there in the studio, and can be five. Plug another one in.
Oh, yeah.
So, you do have a complicated setup. Well, tell me, now the mics that you guys use, seems like they're Heil mics. Is that right?
Yeah, Leo is a big fan of the Heil PR40. Mm-hmm. I've also, I really like the sound of the Rode microphone that they use over at CNET. It's the RE20. Is that the correct?
Well, the RE20 is an EV microphone, but there are Rode microphones too.
The Rode Broadcaster. It's probably the Rode Broadcaster.
Oh, yeah.
That might be
that's the popular one. Yeah.
So I always confuse it because RE92s are a type of car tire that I'm very familiar with. So they use the same RE thing. And I'm like, oh, it's the RE92 microphone that sounded really good. I should look into that. Oh, that's a car tire.
What your studio there is not quite typical for a radio studio because it's more like a TV studio. You guys don't even have monitor speakers in your studio because it's live on TV all the time.
Right.
So you've got a bleed speaker that the guests in the room can hear other voices with if they need to. It's kind of kept kind of low. But what headphones does the talent use? Well, normally it's Leo, but Alex or whoever, or yourself when you're doing a show, what are those headphones?
Right. Leo uses AKG headphones. Let me look up the particular model.
That's the K240s.
K240? Yeah, I have a little portion of the Twit website that I call Twit Picks, where I just post all the stuff that we like a lot because everyone always asks, oh, what are those headphones? So it's on there. twit.tv/picks/AKG_K240_headphones.
Ah, there
you
go.
So you are correct, okay. Sir.
All right. Well, cool. Well, Colleen, we're going to have you back on another show if you'd be so kind, and I want to really get into the IT, especially now that you guys are doing some really cool real-time video streaming.
Yeah, I mean, what we just started doing last night is we were kind of – our dream is we're going to be having little television networks – throughout the – well, we're going to be the large overall network, but little stations around the world. So kind of as the sun, goes around the Earth, or I should say the Earth spins, we can, we can have Brian Brushwood in Austin, Texas. We can have someone in Europe. We can have someone in the Middle East. We can have someone in India, someone in Asia, someone in Hawaii. And as one studio finishes up their shows for the day, the next one takes over. And we just do all this live content production wherever we are.
Oh, how cool.
So
yeah.
We're going to have that to be able to do very scalable, very dynamic, very easy content production all over the world and then feed all of those audio sources to all other places. And it has to be two-way. So there has to be, a mix going on in, say, Texas and a mix going on here, and they have to talk to each other and everyone has to hear each other but not themselves. And
does Leo ever think up easy projects for you to do?
I think we got a coffee maker once that I had to install.
That was about yeah. It's the same for us broadcast engineers too. It's usually a program director that thinks up something that that they want to do different, and you just don't know how complicated that is.
Oh yeah, I mean, yes. When people, it's kind of like when Leo said, "Oh yeah, I want to have multiple people on Skype video," and I said, "Well, it doesn't support that," and then he says, "We'll figure it out," and I said, "Okay."
That sounds like the program director I work with at here at New York at WINS.
Yeah.
Well, that's the nice thing. I mean, a lot of people in the IT world, unlike the broadcast world, I find have this problem where they're going to tell you what they can't do all the time. And what I want to hear and what I hear from broadcast people all the time is what they can do or how they can do it or, how to change it so that they can do something very similar.
Colleen, you're welcome to hang with us for the rest of the show if that's good for you. If not, we'll let you go and bring you on a different time for some
IT I would
work.
Like to listen in and see what you guys are talking about.
Absolutely. We had just talked through the broadcast chains in our different types of radio stations. Mine's pretty simple in Mississippi. Chris Tarr described kind of a pretty mid-size radio station, and Chris Tobin described how WINS works. I think I'd like to get to chatting about some of the specific gear that we like or that is typically used in broadcast. If you go to some of the retailers or the catalog or online sellers who sell broadcast and podcaster gear, you'll be just amazed with such a range of equipment. And yet it seems like broadcasters tend to gravitate to the same three or four or five brands and models of equipment. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it's a comfort level. Chris Tobin, you've been around New York City a lot. You've certainly dealt with a lot of different talent that may have liked, you know, this mic or that headphone from one place or another that they've worked in the past. Let's talk for 5 minutes about microphones. Chris, you mentioned the Shure SM7 is a favorite among the newscasters there. And I think you mentioned the RE27. Actually, I've got one of those here in the studio with me. I'm not using it. I'm using a Violet mic, which is a bit more fragile, but also very clear sounding. Tell me about your choices in the studios there and how you deal with the talent.
Okay, our choice is that currently it is an SM7, Shure Brothers SM7 microphone. We came to the conclusion that that was the best choice for the overall sound. Since in our business being radio and what little video content we currently have on our website, the audio has to sound something natural. And we found the RE27 was just a little too raspy, if that's the proper term, or too much treble. Okay, and you look at the graph, the frequency response of the microphone, you'll see there's a little bump at around 10 kilohertz, which is just what you don't want. And we actually had complaints from listeners. People would complain there was something about the station doesn't sound right, and it's annoying. So the programming folks came to us in engineering and said, we need to reevaluate. This radio station is 42 years of old news. It's it's mentioned on station TV shows like CSI New York, Sopranos. Movies are written about it. We need to fix this right now.
Okay.
Right. Weeks went on. We had microphones of every type, from Neumann to the Rode Broadcaster, which actually came in second to the SM7 and RE27s. RE20s people would bring from their home collection, because we did discover that some of the older RE20s actually sound better than the newer version.
Ah, okay.
Don't know why, but there is definitely a difference. But at the end of the day, it was the SM7. The talent, the comfort zone, RE27. Everybody, the FM jocks, the AM news presenters, the sports folks, all wanted RE27s until they sat down in the booth and started listening to their playback of their voice on every microphone. And they just sat there going, wow. So I sort of got them out of their comfort zone and said, hey, try something new. It's a little bit out of the box. I'm shifting the paradigm, but it's still going to get the end result that you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did. The all sports station is SM7s. The all news station is SM7s. The FMs have decided not to go in that direction. They claim it doesn't sound right.
Chris, you mentioned something in the testing that intrigued me. You said that, if I got it right, that they liked the sound of the RE27s when they were recording, and I'm assuming listening to themselves. But upon playback, it may have sounded different to them.
Well, as you know, and I've done a lot of studying of this, bone conduction, auditory response of the human brain is predicated on two things, what you see and what you hear. And the brain will translate depending on what goes on between the two senses. And when you listen to yourself back in microphones or headphones, that is, with a microphone, you have a certain sound. We all have our own unique sound. That's just the way it's going to be. Bone conduction does it for you. You play it back, and it's the real sound that everybody else hears, and all of a sudden you're like, wow, I purposely did that test. I tried to create a baseline and say, look, folks, this is what people really hear. You need to understand what we're talking about. And then they were like, well, how do I get what I want to hear in my headphones? Well, we'll do an offside, headphone audio chain for you, and you could tweak it as you like.
Uh-huh.
And we did. Huh. And that's how we got it so that it works for them. But they love it. I mean, we've had people compliment to the sound. For an AM 50,000-watt station, it sounds really good, and it translates onto our web stream as well as our HD2 carriers as well. So it's
Now, that's something I find really interesting coming from, again, an IT background, is that I actually grew up. I was the only kid in my age group that was obsessed with talk radio on AM. I have no idea why. I always listened to KGO radio in San Francisco. And then there was also I'm forgetting that it's AM 740 here, KCBS, and they have now an AM and an FM stream. They sound totally different, and people get completely used to these strange kind of changes that happen with the equipment that's between you and the other end. I mean, the transmission spectrum or the microphones, and in the end, really, nobody sounds on air what they sound like in real life.
That's true.
These are all just tools. They're paintbrushes of what you're trying to inflect, how you want to sound, and what And in the end, how you hear yourself is not how other people hear you. So it's a really tough problem.
It is. It's very subjective. Don't get me wrong. I don't try to tell the folks, hey, this is making you sound better. It's just it's a consistent sound, and it hopefully will help contribute to what the overall image of the radio station is trying to bring out to the audience. So
now,
yeah,
where do you go
right.
when you want to find out things like this? Because we're constantly looking for good microphones. We simply don't have that much knowledge about it right now, and I find it. You know, you can't listen to microphones on your speakers here. You can't listen. You know, how do you test out microphones to decide what's best for your application? Do you order all of them?
Well, there was a time when you could get samples and have that happen, and they don't do that much anymore. A lot of it comes from me doing it for 20-plus years, knowing a lot of folks, calling up to all my friends, if you will, and the network of people I know, and say, hey, what are you using lately? What model? And then finding it in a collection somewhere. I actually have a lot of friends who have extra microphones laying around that I can call up and say, hey, do you have this? Oh, yeah, by the way, we do. And I'll give it a try. Or I'll go to a facility and say, hey, I see you using this particular microphone, the AKG tube mic, which I used to use when I worked for a radio network. Very nice microphone. Sounds great. However, in certain applications, it's just useless. I went to the network studio and said, can I take a listen to this for a while and make some recordings? Yeah, no problem. It's hard. It's not an easy slam dunk to call up AKG, sure, Electro Voice, or even Heil and say, hey, can I borrow a microphone for a week and try it out? Yeah. But I have,
especially if you're a podcaster, if you're at home and you're in your own garage, I mean, you can't do that.
No, I think the best thing to do is look for the forums in the broadcast community. There are a lot of forums that you can look to see what people say about microphones and how they sound and what they do. Or listen to a radio station, or even television, but radio. And if you hear something that sort of tickles your ear and you say, wow, that's interesting, call the radio station. I've done it. I was traveling in Europe one time and I heard something on a German station. I was like, wow, this sounds really interesting. Turned out to be an old-fashioned Telefunken microphone that I read about, didn't think anybody was using. They were using it, and I said, wow, that's why it sounds the way it does. And I read about it, and it had a unique sound, and he loved it.
I want something called the Telefunken.
Yeah. Colleen, in Europe, they have broadcasting houses often are called funk houses.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Hey, oh, it's it's awesome. Hey, in fact, if you get a chance, you and anybody else listening to the show, go to YouTube and search for Axia. And I think if you look Axia Funk House, that's Funkhaus, Funk House, or Axia Südtirol, which is part of northern Italy, you'll see a beautiful brand new Funk House.
Sistema Axia at Funk House Italy.
That might be it. That might be it. Hey, Chris Tarr, how about the beer drinkers in Milwaukee? What do you guys use for microphones?
I'll tell you what, we have funk houses all over the place out here. But that's a whole different story.
They're not radio stations. Sorry.
Yeah, you really don't want to step in there unannounced. Colleen actually kind of hit it on the head with kind of an artist thing. You know, I have different microphones that I like to use for different applications. And, you know, some of it, too, depends on the situation here. Now, for example, Chris wasn't real happy with the way the RE27s worked on Winds. I use them on my AM sports station, and they're great. But the situation's a little different with me in that instead of a 50,000-watt station, I've got a 5,000-watt station that, you know, really needs to cut through a lot of noise and that sort of thing. And the one thing about the 27 is it, because of that high end, has kind of a penetrating quality to it that works out very well for that. But I actually, with three radio stations in Milwaukee, each station has a different set of microphones. With our AM sports station, we have the RE27. With our top 40 station, we have the RE20, just because it's got a real good presence to it. But on our kind of light rock station, we use an SM5. They don't make them anymore, but they're wonderful microphones. Oh. They're very open and airy. They look like a big old football.
Yeah, this is the one that looks like a football.
Yeah.
And the sponge will hold any disease that any of the announcers have.
Oh, talk about a funk house. Yeah.
Oh, God. You know, recently I pulled off the pop screens on Leo's microphones downstairs and the guest microphones. Oh. Wow. That's some funk.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, those are certified health risks there, those suckers, I'm telling you. But, you know, the SM5 is a real, kind of a bright, airy, open, full sound to it. And, in fact, I wanted to test RE20s in that studio, and I just about got ran out of town when I tried to do it. The guys on the air love it. So, you know, and again, it depends on the type of format that you're doing, I think, and kind of, the things that you're trying to accomplish. I mean, different mics have different characteristics. And the Heil mics that Colleen was talking about, I actually, another guy at Intercom in Denver swears by them, loves them, put them in the studios there and thinks they sound phenomenal. So it sometimes even is a good idea to break that mold and try something other than the Electro Voices and the Shures and, you know, those sites, the Neumanns and that sort of thing, and try something different. And you might be surprised at what you're going to find.
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely.
Good advice. Well, we've talked about mics a lot. What about, you know, something that used to be in every radio studio, at least since maybe the late 80s, and that would be a CD player. A lot of stations still have them as a backup, or some stations are still playing some CDs.
That's a lie.
Yeah, no.
No, it's not.
It's true.
Yeah, we rerun some things. Well, we have a on our Top 40 station, we have a mix show, which is just, you know, songs mixed together and things, that all is delivered on CD.
So the show comes to you on CD.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do shows? Well, some shows does American Top 40 or those kind of syndicated weekly shows still come on CD?
No, those are all downloads now. Yeah. And you know, but the other thing that people don't think about is we're a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week thing. If our automation system crashes, we have no digital files to play. Yeah. So you've got to have a CD player there with a bunch of songs. So that we have something to put on the air until we get the system back up.
I would think it would be easier just to have, you know, a laptop or two around plugged in with a card and a UPS backup, and you hit play.
Yeah, it's getting there. You know, the thing is in the broadcast world, really radio automation with digital files really hadn't come into its own until about a year or two ago, surprisingly enough. Up until that time, and you know, Kirk and Chris can probably discuss this too. Each automation system that did this digital playback had their own proprietary formats for their audio. So you had to use their system in order to play the audio.
And it wasn't necessarily the coding scheme that was proprietary. Most of them used either APTX or MPEG Layer 2 or some Layer 3. But they all had different file wrappers or different headers.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, to describe the nature of the file. And Chris, maybe you know that because I don't. Have they gotten to a more standardized format, the BW Wave format or the broadcast?
As far as I can tell, no.
No.
It's still the same. Although they have gotten to the point where you can at least, you know, have the raw wave file with at least some data in there, and some of the systems will actually hold, the MP3 tagging.
Yeah.
Although they won't use that information for in the on-air system for playback information.
Well, so much of this is broadcast specific. There's so many things that a broadcaster needs to know that isn't part of the MP3 tag, even the latest, greatest, most complicated MP3 tagging.
They need more metadata than that.
Yeah, they do. Here's an interesting thing for you, just to hit all our listeners around the world. In India, if your automation system, tagging system, whatever makes all the info about the file, if it doesn't have a field for you to put in the name of the movie that the song is from, then they're not interested. Because every song is from a movie in India.
Bollywood.
Yep. Yeah, Bollywood. Every song. And so several American purveyors of software to schedule songs and software to playback songs have gone to India and realized that, oh, our software is not so good for the Indian market after all. Because the movie is critical.
It's kind of like some of the software Chevy Nova translation in the Spanish language.
Yeah, it doesn't go. Yes,
I was going to say, some of these vendors, you know, their stuff isn't good enough for the American market, let alone it. But I digress.
No, but I mean, this is what I'm talking about with the IT market with so many, frankly, there's old media and new media. And there's, old media has so much wisdom and so much developed knowledge. That's truly amazing. But the people who are doing, you know, internet broadcasting, I mean, and frankly, in a couple of years, everything, your television, your phone, your data, everything is going to come over one TCP/IP pipe into your home and one wireless pipe, whether you're making a phone call, watching TV, because it's just cheaper that way and it's easier that way. And there's so much complication because of this legacy of older broadcasting technologies that when a computer person looks at it, they say, well, why can't I just do this? Why doesn't this just work? And they say, oh, because, you know, you have to do this and that. And, you know, you have to mark in here and mark out there when video editing. And I'm like, why?
Right. Well, you actually you bring up a very good discussion, Colleen, in that we're in the broadcast engineering field. We're at the same point. You know, we have a lot of these legacy analog, you know, this is the way we've done things type of engineers. And then the younger guys like me, who I also had an IT background before I got into the broadcast engineering side. And, you know, I'll say, well, why isn't this delivered this way, or why isn't it done this way? And usually the answer is, oh, well, we've always done it this way. We haven't really thought about it. And so we're kind of at that tipping point now with delivery systems and, you know, HD radio and things like that, where guys like me are starting to be making those decisions.
Right.
And you're starting to see that kind of head that direction. But, you know, we're suffering from the same things here for those same reasons.
Wow. Well, what should we move to next? We've talked about a lot of these interconnects. You know, let's ask this question. Is there still a place for analog wiring connections in a really modern new studio? And if so, where?
I'm going to say no.
Okay, I would agree with Chris, no.
I'm going to say there's a place for copper wire that can be used for either.
Aha. Uh-huh. That's very insightful.
This is true.
Just like, you know, what's the name of the company that makes the Cat 5, Cat 6 adapters so that you can use those networking cables for all
Studio
sorts
Hub.
Of analog audio?
No, you, and, yeah.
Radio systems. Studio Hub.
We use that stuff here. And, you know, we're going to be building a new studio over the next couple of months, and I'm going to be building everything with Cat 6 and coaxial cables.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And frankly, it doesn't matter what the layout of the studio is going to be. I'm going to run those two types of cables everywhere. And then I just put those connectors on the end and plug what I need to into them.
I remember a few years ago when this was actually a point of controversy, people were wiring studios with a special AES balanced cable. And the question came up, can we use Cat 5 instead of this special AES cable? And Chris Tobin, Chris Tarr, do you remember the specs? I mean, obviously the answer was, yeah, you can. It's at the edge of the impedance spec, but you know what? It works fine.
Yes, you can do twisted pair cable, which is what the Cat 5, Cat 6 spec is about. The trick is the proper termination. It's the laws of physics. You can use any length of cable you'd like, and it'll work just fine, as long as you terminate it properly on both ends. So if you want to do AES, terminate properly, it'll pass it. You want to do audio and minimize roll-off at the high frequencies because of capacitance resistive, terminate it properly. Digital, the same way.
Now, what is proper termination? How would you say that you would properly terminate an AES cable made from Cat 5?
They have what they call bollums or transformers that will take the impedance of the cable that's currently connected to it. And Cat 5, I think, is around 100 ohms or 110
right.
ohms. So it will either transfer it to a semi-professional level AES, which is typically the SPDIF, or professional, which is 110, so it doesn't even change anything. You can just go directly from connector to cable.
Colleen, this is why in your studio at TWiT, why we couldn't just take a balanced CAT cable and put it into that one of the unbalanced inputs on the TriCaster.
Or maybe no.
Maybe it was vice versa, but we had
Yeah, there's that. But also what we went ahead and did recently with your recommendation is we our TriCaster broadcast does AES out and AES in via BNC coaxial cable.
Ah, the TV standard for AES.
Right. Is that balanced or unbalanced BNC? Does it have a plastic ring at the base of the BNC by chance?
Yes.
That's balanced.
Okay. Yeah. And then, so I used, BNC to a Balun that turns it into XLR, which goes into the converter that goes into Cat 5 and then into the Axia unit.
And that's the proper termination you have to do. The BNC is technically a 50 ohm connector. That's what you're working with.
Or is it 75 ohm in TV or is it 50 ohm?
I think BNC, they may change it. It may be 75. I'll double check. But BNC by nature, I believe, is 50.
Well, they have two different sizes for the center conductor, and hence it changes the dielectric size.
They probably, so if it's TV, it's probably 75.
Yeah, TV video, I think it's 75, yeah. Sure. Wow.
But you're going from balanced, it's a balanced connection to the bottom and then back to an unbalanced, yes.
And this is why I love Ethernet.
It's got one connector.
Plug it in and it works.
I want one connector that goes everywhere all the time.
You know, in my presentations where I'm promoting and educating people about Axia and networking, that's one of the big points. I show them all the audio connectors that we use in analog and digital audio, from barrier strips to 110 punch blocks and 66 blocks to RCA connectors to XLRs to 1/8-inch phono and 1/4-inch phono and all this craziness that we have done over the years. And, you know, every time one of these connectors comes along, it's a good idea for the purpose.
Right.
But here we are in 2009, and we just have too many connectors. We reduce this down to RJ45s. Now, I tell you, some people are still not excited about putting a microphone on an RJ45. So,
You can do it.
You sure
can. As long as you properly connect it.
Yeah.
I went to Belden School for this. They demonstrate how you can do it. 100 feet of Cat 5 cable with a mic level will work.
Wow.
It's scary, but it does work.
And well, by scary, you mean awesome.
It's scary. It's awesome. I mean, unfortunately, I'm considered a maverick in my world because I go for the crazy stuff. You know, people look at me like, that's just crazy. You don't use Cat 5 on a microphone. No, you can if you do it this way. It makes
Please
so much
come
easier.
To our studio sometime. I would love to learn from you. That's what I think.
Yeah, Chris, if you're ever out in California, you need to go. The Twit Studio is a cool place.
I watched the video. I'd love to check it out.
Hey, let's chat about one more thing that would go into our listener's question, and that is, sometimes I get asked, what's the purpose of an audio console? Why do I need that? What does it do? And, you know, from the most basic standpoint, it just helps you switch the right thing on the air or on your program at the right time. If you have 5 microphones, you don't want them all turned on at the same time. You'll pick up all kinds of room noise. Or if you want to, we'll blast from the past, if you want to cue up a CD or, heaven forbid, a record, you need to do that not on the air, but you need to, when that's done, you need to be able to turn it on the air. Well, so that's the basic purpose of a console, to mix these things together to a common program output. But what we find is we build some extra utility into consoles, not only the company I work for, but all console companies build in extra utility that ends up getting used a lot. I know at the Twit Network they're using other buses, like we have a Program 1 bus, but then we also have a Program 2 and a Program 3 and a Program 4.
Oh, hell yeah.
On some consoles it's called the Audition bus. There are auxiliary buses. So, Chris Tarr, can you maybe address for us for a minute what's the purpose of these other buses that we find in audio consoles?
Oh, they make the magic happen. What they do is they basically can take all these audio inputs that you have into your nerve center there, the console, and use them for different feeds and for different purposes. So you can essentially not only use that console for turning things on and off and, you know, increasing volume, lowering volume, but you can also use it as a distribution point. You know, for example, what we do is when we have live broadcasts, and we have people call in, the talent out of the live broadcast calling into a radio station to do their broadcasts, we can send information down through the audition bus that's separate from what's on the air. So, for example, if we want to talk to them and we want to do it, off the air, we can do it through the audition bus. If we want to feed, other programming down to them, we can do that through the audition bus. Another great example is on Friday mornings, we have a TV station come in and they, film the guys on the air, but they want to do it to also get the off the air conversations through the microphones. So we're able to provide a bus for that. So it basically allows you to separate whatever you're sending out on the air and, you know, separate those into little chunks and feed them to all different places using these different buses.
It's a keyboard and mouse with a monitor.
Here in Nashville, just down the road from me, is the headquarters of the Dave Ramsey Show. He has a syndicated show. It's on 450 radio stations. And Dave's one of these guys. He does the radio show over, he distributes via satellite. It goes from Nashville to New York, and then it goes via satellite to the 450 affiliate radio stations. And that feed contains everything. In other words, it contains the show opens and closes, the bumper music. It contains the network commercials that Dave Ramsey is entitled to run on the network. Well, they also have not one but two different internet versions of the show. One version also has commercials. Another, but there may be different commercials. Another version has no commercials. That's for the paid subscribers. So on their console, happens to be an Axia console, on their console, they record three different versions of the show at the same time. The version that goes out, another version that I forget is missing something or other, forget which it is, and another version with no commercials. And they do this by either assigning or not assigning a given fader or a given input to a given bus. In their case, bus one has everything. That's the whole show. Bus two has a little bit less than the whole show. And bus three has, I know, no commercials. And you know what? I think it has no bumper music. That's it. Because they want to be able to edit the thing easily and quickly without having to worry about the bumper music being behind Dave's talking. So that's one purpose for a bus. You can do three versions or more of the same show automatically just by getting the right faders assigned to the right buses. Mr. Tobin, what do you guys use buses for there?
It's pretty much the same way. Actually, we feed various audio sources out to the traffic folks, business reporters, field reporters, weather folks. That's pretty much the standard fare. It doesn't change any.
I've got a question for you.
Go ahead.
Those people that are in the field, so say you have someone, you know, doing a report from, you know, a house that's burning down, do they hear mix minus?
Yes, they do.
Or do they hear themselves?
No, they hear mix minus, but what I have done with the USB mixers, I'll have them locally mix their audio into their headset so they can hear the ambient sound around them and themselves. But it is true mix minus from the studio.
Okay.
So the people in the field are locally mixing themselves with the mix minus coming back to them.
You have to, because the brain and your brain is always listening for a side tone. That's why your telephone has your voice coming back.
Well, that's why a wired phone does. Unfortunately, wireless phones often don't have side tone.
They can't. Well, they're actually injecting. They're slowly doing it, but it's tough because of the digital.
I was going to say, my voice over IP phone system, there's a setting in there for the amount of background noise to inject.
Yeah, but the brain needs to hear that. Otherwise, you're always constantly yelling at you. You're yelling. That's that closed loop feedback.
So earlier I alluded to this thing called mix minus, and Colleen just mentioned it too. And let's explain that for just a sec for folks who need to know about this. This is a common question when I take calls, people wanting to know about how to put a caller on their podcast or hook up a telephone hybrid into their studio. It's important that it's important that the caller hear you, so the caller can hear your question or maybe hear a song snippet or something. Hey, can you identify this blast from the past? You know, that sort of thing. So we have to feed audio to the caller, but you know what? We can't feed the caller back to the caller. That's what we have to avoid. And so if you take an audio console and you take the program output of the console and you hook that into the port on the hybrid that feeds audio back to the caller, when you turn the caller up on the console, you're going to be feeding the caller back to the caller. The clearest way I know to say it, and that's going to be confusing to the caller, and it's also not going to sound good when you put the caller on the air. So what we do is we have to feed everything but the caller to the caller. Now, we can also feed a smaller subset of that. We could just feed, you know, the jock microphone or a mix of all the microphones in the studio back to the caller. But
if you don't want to distract them with the music if the radio jock wants to hear their engineer, but you don't want the guest to hear their engineer.
Exactly. So on most audio consoles, what we would do is we would pick one of the buses on the console. And some consoles have a specific telephone bus. But we pick some bus on the console and we put everything into that bus, but not the caller. Or we put whatever we want to in the bus, the things that we want the caller to hear. But we definitely don't put the caller into that bus. We don't assign that fader to that bus. And we take that bus and feed that to the caller. That's the way we traditionally made our own mix minuses in the past. Now, more modern consoles, Axia being among them, but some others as well, can make an automatic mix minus. Since they're mixing everything in software, they have some DSP power available to know that, hey, this source is a source that can receive a back feed, something going back to it. So we're going to not feed itself back to it. So the console can instantaneously come up with a feed just for that that device. We might call that a back feed. You might call it a dynamic bus for that caller. Guys, is that pretty well explained, mix minus?
Yeah. That's it. Yes.
Okay. Absolutely. But I think that it becomes even more important when you're using networks where they're A, digital, and B, have latency issues.
Oh, yeah.
So if you're, for example, using, the internet, for example, and you're trying to talk to someone, if you're feeding their audio back to them, not only are they hearing themselves, but they're hearing themselves almost a second ago sometimes.
Oh, yes.
Depending on
ISDN.
How bad their latency is.
you know, an older thing we used to do back when we did a lot of ISDN or even satellite remote broadcasts, because of there's such a huge delay between the, you know, the two points, is we'd actually feed a mixed mice down the phone line to the talent, and then they were actually live over the satellite on the way back. So at least we cut the delay in half.
Well, this is what happens, you know, when reporters are in the field with a satellite video phone in Iraq. And they say, well, now let's go to Bob in Baghdad. And then Bob in Baghdad standing there looking around. Then finally, Bob in Baghdad says, yes, we're live here in Baghdad. Well, that delay is his queuing delay in the case of a satellite phone. It's all the delay of the encoding, the satellite link, and sometimes double hop, and the decoding at the other end. And this can be a couple of seconds in each direction. So, you know, a total of 3 or 4 seconds. So it does look pretty funky, and that's the TV version of it. The same thing can happen in radio too.
Right.
Well, guys, let's talk about one more quick thing before we have to go, and that is audio processing for the application that we're in. If we're an AM radio station versus an FM radio station, and I really want to be basic here. I'm not going to talk about all the different features of multiband or you know, all the fine points of processing, but I just want to point out that it's important to have the right kind of audio processing for the job at hand. Now, maybe Mr. Tobin could tell us why that's important. Why can't, well, first of all, why do I need some audio processing? And second of all, why should it be the, you know, why can't I use an old FM audio processor for my internet stream?
Well, you need the processing to limit the bandwidth of what you're putting down the pipe. So if the pipe is the internet or if it's an AM or FM transmission medium, they have limited bandwidth. So you want to keep it confined.
Now, that's the audio frequencies, right?
Audio frequencies,
when you say
yes.
Bandwidth, that's not bits. That's
not the bits, no.
Okay.
But if it's for internet and you're processing audio, or you're going through a codec, whether it be Skype, as we're using now, or something else, that codec still has a limited bandwidth, Nyquist theorem and all everything else. So you still want to control what you put into it to get the proper sound out. Taking an FM processor and throwing it on an AM radio station without turning off anything else in it can be troublesome because of the different technical specs for FM transmission standards. If you turn off some of that stuff, maybe you can make it work, but it shouldn't be done. Same thing with internet. Internet, you could probably take a processor from somewhere, FM or AM, modify it a bit and put it on the internet. But again, you have to understand what you're trying to do. And one thing I've discovered, and I'm sure others have, too much processed audio into codecs today, anything compressed audio, compressed meaning digitally compressed algorithms like MPEG, APTX, or AAC, require a certain amount of dynamic range, peaks and valleys in the audio. When you start to take that away, those algorithms fall apart. So the processing is key. You want to keep those peaks and valleys, but keep it robust so it at least has some oomph to it.
That good advice. What I like to explain to folks is that, you know, whether it's an AM transmission, an FM transmission, or if it's some kind of internet feed that's gone through a codec, or if it's a satellite uplink where that's also likely going through some kind of codec, each of those transmission schemes has certain attributes. It has strong points and weak points. And the idea of an audio processor not only is to take diverse audio levels and kind of wrangle them a bit, you know, get them within a range that is going to be useful for our transmission medium, but also it's to an audio processor should exploit the good points of a transmission medium and should minimize the weaknesses of a transmission medium, so that you get the most information, the most useful, good sounding information through that transmission medium. And this would apply certainly to different bit rates of an internet stream codec, or whether you're doing FM audio transmission, you know, terrestrial FM, or whether you're doing AM. Each of these has very different characteristics, and that's why it's important to prep that audio for that kind of transmission. Chris Tarr, you have several different schemes for transmitting audio at Intercom, don't you?
I sure do, and I actually have a different way of encoding them for, you know, or processing each stream. You know, for example, for our HD, which is, you know, a similar kind of a modified AAC codec is what HD radio is using. I use an Omnia 1, which has a codec designed for those lower bit rates. Of course, on the analog signal, I have a whole lot of square wave generators that just crush the audio. But then also with the streaming, I bypass most of all of that aggressive limiting and compressing, and I'm using just a very simple, wideband kind of just a gain controller, because as Chris Tobin said, you know, you can only take, you know, you need those peaks and valleys for those codecs to work efficiently, especially with streaming audio. But on the other hand, you know, that digital bucket, you know, unlike, you know, the old days of analog where you could, you know, turn the audio up until it reached saturation and it would just kind of get a little fuzzy sounding. When you fill out, you know, when you turn all those zeros to ones, that's it. Anything after that is bad news. So you've got to have some sort of control on those levels, but you still need all that dynamic range for those codecs to work efficiently. So, you know, to simply answer your question, you know, we have several different methods of getting the audio out, and each one of them has their own processing with different goals.
When working with Colleen at the Twit Studios a few months ago and a few times in the intervening time, boy, I sure had a learning curve to go through myself. I honestly consider myself kind of, you know, reasonably an expert on AM and FM processing. I've certainly been hired to go out and do consulting in different countries on that sort of thing. But man, I had more to learn than I thought when I went to the Twit Studios and looked at all the different things that they were doing, the different codecs, different codec rates, and the various recordings they were doing. Colleen, are things finally kind of starting to settle in there with regard to audio at the Twit Studios?
In theory. Nothing really settles down here all that much. What we're actually doing right now is we're transitioning over to producing both audio and video content. And one of the things that we're attempting to do is, rather than using multi-track audio in Adobe Audition and producing Final Cut Pro edited video, we're trying to produce Final Cut Pro edited video that can be directly released as a perfect audio podcast simultaneously. So one of the things that we're doing is we're actually capturing 4 audio tracks in Final Cut Pro, since that's a limitation of the Kona 3 card that we're using to capture the AES audio. And so we're doing 1 mix down, you know, 1 tune mix down, 1, you know, single track of Leo and 1 single track of, you know, the primary guest. And, you know, it's nice, but it's not quite as flexible as the Adobe Audition was, when you could record 16, 20 tracks of audio all at once. And then all that's, you know, really nice for the recorded aspect, but then that gets all blasted out to other things that convert it, you know, from analog, because right now we've got ADVCs, which have to feed DV audio and video into our streaming video computers. So we actually have to convert it to analog, feed analog audio and video to the digital converter that converts it back to digital and then shoves those into the computers, which blast it out on the internet over flash media. And so those use MP3 audio, as well as we also do MP3 audio only streams. So there's a constant adjustment of trying to figure out, all right, we want the best content possible audio-wise for the people who have high bandwidth connections, but we want good enough for people who live in places where they have very limited bandwidth, or they have capped bandwidth, or they have dial-up connections. So we're using, you know, like 64 kilobit mono audio for streaming internet radio. Uh-huh. So things are calming down a little bit, but, you know, I've still got so much to learn about how best to treat each of those connections individually, because as you were saying, they're all so different.
They are, and since I left and did my last work at the Twit Network, I noticed that I what I'm hearing on your podcast and on your live stream is sounding better and better. So I think whatever changes you guys have made, I've consulted a bit with you and also a bit with Eric and Tony, and also brought Cornelius Gould into the mix. I do think it's
that's the coolest name I've ever heard, by the way.
Cornelius
Gould.
Yeah, he was on our show a few weeks ago.
Which episode?
6, I think. 5 or 6.
So that would be Corny DSP.
Yeah,
I'm not
one.
Up to that one yet.
Yeah, that's the show I messed up.
Yeah, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. I'm getting my education in the audio part from this podcast, not from anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, folks, we've about to use up all our time, and I wish we had more, but we don't. So we'll have Colleen back as a guest another time. That would be great to hear some of the IT stories that she has from the Twit Network, which is, you know, a new media kind of place. And then Chris Tarr.
I've got so many questions for you guys, so please come back.
Well, anytime.
Help me.
Well, we'd love to have you back on. So, hey, we're going to have in the show notes a place for you to read a little bit about Colleen Kelly. So check the show notes on the website. The website is thisweekinradiotech.com. www.thepraideroad.com. If you're listening to this podcast, you may have gotten it off of iTunes. And if you haven't, well, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Go to iTunes Store and just search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, or This Week in Radio Tech. You can subscribe to it there. You can get the RSS feed of it off of the website as well at thisweekinradiotech.com. Chris Tobin, thank you very much for joining us from New York City this evening.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Hope you have a great time if you're going to the parade on Turkey Day.
I'm covering the parade. We're doing live broadcasts from two locations, wireless microphones, and going crazy.
I don't want to see you in the 6 o'clock news, though.
Oh, trust me, you won't.
Be careful. Chris Tarr from Milwaukee. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We look forward to having you back next week, if possible.
Absolutely.
All right. And Colleen, thank you for joining us as well. Sure appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And another This Week in Radio Tech is in the can.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another twirt has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech. Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show. Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store. Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.